It's like very gradually, like the snow falling that Ocean alluded to the first night we were here. Somehow it seems like I'm looking around and there's many more snowflakes than when we first arrived. I kind of haven't noticed people coming in, but all of a sudden things feel fuller. As we've been hearing last night and reminded again this morning, we're really kind of at the midpoint of this session. It's the third morning, and I think the change is kind of beginning to be palpable. There's a quality of movement, of sound, of speech. There's just a quality in the whole place that's shifted and that's continuing to shift. And I think we could say it's samadhi steeped. Last night, just the last period, kind of out of the corner of my eye, I could see the evening Jikido offering incense. And it was just one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. Just the amount of consideration and care going into this one simple, innocuous movement. I could have watched him actually forever. And I don't think he was particularly aware of it. I think he was just trying very, very hard to simply light the incense and walk back to his seat. But the quality of consideration deepened my own samadhi. I was changed simply by being in the presence of his engagement, his full engagement. So we're not separate. So at this point, we can really use this energy that we've been cultivating alone and with each other, or we can check out. In a sense, you know, I think we can have a mistaken view of samadhi, and we can actually think it's about anesthetizing ourselves. But we've come here to really cultivate and experience this quality of mind, this samadhi mind, which our zazen just naturally generates, regardless of if we're aware of it or not. And we can't get this quality of mind at home in our lives. We can sit every morning for an hour or however much you all sit every morning. But it's not the same as moving in and out of zazen throughout the day, consistently, alone and with others. The only way we get this is coming on retreat together. And mostly we're not even aware that we're in this state of samadhi, because samadhi has nothing to do with knowing. Although God knows, we have so many ideas, infinite ideas, about what we think it is and should be and all the ways in which it's other than where we actually are. And Huineng, in the early part of the Platform Sutra, actually cautions us against this, against having these ideas about samadhi and what we think about oneness. I would say it's probably, it was and has been for me, one of the, I would say, largest dangers of Zen, perhaps any spiritual practice. But he says, the deluded one clings to the characteristics of things, thinking straightforward mind, is sitting without moving, casting aside delusions, without letting things arise in the mind. This kind of practice, which we consider to be oneness, is the same as insentiency. Insentiency, we could just kind of translate as like lifelessness. It's like sitting like a dead rock. And is in fact an obstruction to the flow of the Tao. The Tao must be something that circulates freely. Why should we impede it? If the mind does not abide in things, the Tao circulates freely. If the mind abides in things, thoughts, feelings, whatever, it becomes entangled. So, for me, for some reason, this paragraph was kind of seminal. And I began reading this a while ago, and for some reason, this paragraph is the one that keeps coming to me in different ways at different times. Throughout my life. So I think we could say that, in a sense, our samadhi is really like the great tenderizer, not the anesthetizer, but the tenderizer, really giving us the space and the room to let whatever needs to freely arise, arise. This was now going to be, I think, a very famous line for the Village Zendo, but just let all the meat out arise on the grill. Just let it all arise. This mind is not the same quality of mind that we arrived with. And I think our meditation practice is, in a sense, what teaches us how to let all the meat be on the grill. If all the meat was on the grill and we felt like we had to eat all of it and keep it all down, wouldn't be pretty. So we allow our thoughts, our emotions to just arise. Maybe cook for a little bit. Maybe not. Maybe they're better raw. But we just let them arise and dissolve. Come and go with the movement of the breath. Just to touch a little bit on the story of Queen Ang, the sixth patriarch. Probably many of you know this, but I'm sure many of you, you know, don't know this. We think everybody, you know, knows all these like strange little Zen stories, but you know, why would you? I didn't really remember this story until I, you know, reread this book. So, the first part of the sutra is his autobiography, and as Roshi kind of alluded to, what's kind of, you know, significant here is that he really began his life as an illiterate woodcutter. You know, he wasn't schooled and trained to be a great scholar of the text or to be some official temple priest. And while he was working, he accidentally overheard someone reciting the Diamond Sutra, and at hearing this, his mind felt clear. And I think it's likely that he probably recognized something that he probably sensed he always knew, but he'd never actually heard before. But having this experience, he knew he needed to go and find the Buddha Dharma, to seek this clarity out further. So he left his home, and he went off to the temple of Hung Jen, who was the fifth patriarch, who was the teacher who gave the monk or whomever he overheard reciting the sutra to read. And his kind of unusually deep insight, and, you know, I would say we're kind of led to believe that part of that maybe because he didn't already have all these ideas about what he was looking for. So his unusual insight was kind of recognized fairly quickly by the fifth patriarch, who then squirreled him away to an area to sift rice for a long time, where he could really just deepen his insight and to be safe, really, from other members of the temple. And I think it's kind of an interesting side note that there's a couple of places in this where he's having to be, in a way, protected from, you know, the, we could say, even murderous competitive envy, jealousy, rage, anger, you know, all of those things from all the holy monks inside the peaceful Zen monastery. This hotbed of seething and clothed, whatever. Interesting. So the story goes that the fifth patriarch was wanting to pass on the robe, and so he held a contest of sorts for the group, and essentially whoever came up with the verse that revealed the deepest understanding ostensibly would receive the robe and the bowl and transmission. So there was a head monk there, and his was very, very good. And he wrote, "The body is the Bodhi tree. The mind is like a clear mirror. At all times, we must strive to polish it and must not let the dust collect." And this was considered really, really actually very, very clear and good in its way. But he said it's not really complete. There's a way in which his understanding was actually really getting to only half the picture. Huineng, who can't read, was walking through the hallway and saw this thing on the wall and asked another monk to read it to him, which the monk did, and he said, that's very good, but I see it this way. And in response, he writes, Bodhi originally has no tree, the mirror has no stand. Buddha nature is always clean and pure. Where is there room for dust? So in his verse, all the meat's on the grill, and the bottom just completely falls out of the bucket. We've kind of left the realm of ideas about Bodhi, ideas about the mind, and we've just moved into reality, really, in all its openness. There's no tree, and there's no mirror. And here, Buddha nature is always clean and pure. It's not limited to anything we can think of or that we can imagine. And this, of course, includes all of it, even what we think needs to be polished away. As Shinryu said yesterday, we don't need to sweep away the dust. The room's already clean. So this has really huge implications for us. And, you know, it's really not just an interesting idea. This right here, I would say, is what changed and continually changes my life. A couple of weeks ago, I was in a yoga class, and some of you heard part of this story a couple of weeks ago. But there was something about this experience that I had in this class. It was one of those very small personal experiences, which for me was profound. And I think part of the reason that I had it was I had been reading, mulling through the Platform Sutra, and that paragraph I read to you has just been with me. So I'm in this yoga class, and the teacher, Elaine, said, and it was going really well, it was like a really small group, and it was just, everything was going very slow, which I like, and, you know, it's just, and then she says, okay, we're going to go do handstands now, and it was like faster than the speed of light. I just started to check out. It was just like, oh my God, handstands. As maybe you can tell, I really don't like handstands. There's many, many reasons why I don't like handstands. Starting with which I won't go into the details of, but I actually had a previous traumatic handstand trauma 10 years ago where ostensibly supporting somebody going into a handstand, I rushed into their upswinging feet and spent the next hours on my back. Not a good thing to do, rush into upward kicking feet. So there was that side of it, but then there's also the fact that I don't really like jumping. I don't do jumping. Like, jumping does not, I don't find jumping fun. It's not something that I do easily. I really, really don't like being upside down. I really don't like resting on my arms upside down. And then I really don't like trusting somebody else to hold me up and keep me from falling on my head while I'm upside down supported on my arms. So this is, you know, so ingrained that, you know, really for 10 years I've been doing yoga with her. I mean, like, the minute I hear headstands, not headstands, handstands, I definitely don't do headstands. But it's just like something very primal and automatic comes up. This story, really, of that, I don't do it. It's not going to happen. And I can feel, in a way, this immediate separation. What was interesting this time was that I actually, and I think, you know, it was kind of like, because I usually just would feel this kind of aversion and whatever, I would just turn away. And reading this, I just thought, let me see what happens if I just let this arise. Let me just see what's kind of going on here. And it was like watching a movie that I could see myself actually saying to myself this story of, well, I'm not going to do this. I can't do this. I don't do this. I've never done this. And turn away and then begin to go. I just thought, wow, it's really interesting that I'm actually telling myself all these things. And I had never actually noticed myself doing that. I would just do it. Also, I noticed that in that moment, because I couldn't do handstands, I really, really, I would go to say, I mean, I hated Elaine. Like, how could she possibly be doing this? I mean, I just hated her. And then I really resented everybody else in the class who was eagerly about to go jump into doing handstands, which they could all do. And something different happened. This woman, this German woman who was in the class, approached me. And she was, you know, one of those yoga people who just does everything and, you know, seemingly perfectly, which, of course, I'm not noticing, but I'm noticing. And she just comes up to me, and I had, of course, this whole image because of the way she does yoga, you know. I just had this image of what she was going to be, but she came up to me, like, very gently and just really, I don't know, it was sort of shocking. And said, you know, you really can trust Elaine. She's not, you know, your other yoga teacher, and you should try it. You can trust Elaine to do this. And in that moment, I just allowed myself to actually open to her and really hear what she was saying to me. And so often, actually, if somebody tried to say something to me like that, I would actually just shut down. It would just be like, get away from me. I don't want to hear it. You don't know. Just really shut down. But something said, let me just listen to her. And there was something about her tone, her energy, or in me being open, that it was just like, So I didn't even really think about it. And the next thing I knew, I kind of went over to Elaine and was like, here I am. And, you know, I was like terrified, actually. In a way, I was almost, it's strange, I was probably almost shaking. And, you know, Elaine could have made sort of like a big deal of it and like, oh, you don't do this and what have you. But she just sort of met me where I was. It was like, okay, this is a new moment, a new time, and now, right, okay, we're going to just, come on, let's go. We'll do this now. And she said something that, you know, I don't know, it really, I won't ever forget, and really helped. You know, because in the past, in trying to do the headstands, when I would, the handstands, when I would be trying to do them, you know, I would just have this feeling of like endlessly like kicking my legs up in the air and like not going anywhere. And she'd be like, follow your legs, or, you know, kick your legs higher. And it would just be like, I don't know, I just somehow would always end up on the ground or in a ball. And it just was really not pretty. But she said to me, you don't need to make this happen. Just let go into your breath and surrender. Just follow your leg. And I don't know, you know, it was like somehow for the first time in my life, the next thing I knew, I was upside down on my hands and she was holding me. And in that moment, the world and myself were different. And it was kind of amazing to see that for so long I'd been trying so hard in a way to kick and will myself up into the air, even as my body was like grabbing for the ground. And there was something about what happened here. Surrendering really to the moment allowed me to stop abiding in my story. That old, tired sutra, really, that I'd been reciting to myself for years, protecting myself. We have so many of these stories and little sutras about who we are and who we're not, what we can do, what we can't do, what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing. And mostly we don't even see them. but just simply stepping back and letting my mind be quiet enough that I could actually just see the story as it was arising, I could kind of also very quietly and very subtly do something else without knowing the outcome. The story I've been telling myself, I've known the beginning, the middle, and the end. And I know the beginning and the middle and the end so well that there's never any room for anything else to happen in that story. But actually moving away from knowing that story to just watching the story arise and seeing the story was the difference between heaven and earth for myself in that moment. In that moment, I went from hell to heaven. And the thing with the handstand may or may not happen again. I can't say that I actually really liked doing the handstand. I had a very thrilling moment, but I still don't like being upside down on my arms with somebody else holding my legs up in the air. But, you know, that doesn't really matter. You know, I now have had that experience. That experience changed me. I know I can move in and out of that experience freely. And in that moment, what was a closed door and what was a very, very, very solid delusion dissolved. And in the moment of letting it arise, and that seeing was just simply awareness. And its dissolution was freedom. And in that moment, that's all there was. Of course, making room for ever new delusions and enlightenments to continually unfold. So how many stories and how many mini sutras and ideas about yourselves, about others, about the world do you have? Probably endless old ones, endlessly arising new ones. This is our lives, you know, and our stories are also interesting. But where we get into trouble and have so much suffering and actually causes us to be what he calls fettered by them is when we actually stick to them. We believe them to be true and real and unchangeable. Or, as Huinang says, we abide in them. And we can wallow and abide in them endlessly. But we can also not abide in them. And our samadhi really, really allows us to not abide, but to be completely present right now. So I really would just encourage everyone here to really use this wonderful samadhi that we've all been cultivating individually and together. And to really just be present and open to what is inside and out. You actually don't need to make anything happen. Just stay quiet enough so that you can see what is always happening. And in a sense, you know, in our samadhi, we just can become like this very subtle telescope into what's happening inside yourself right now. And it may seem like nothing on the outside, but in Zen, you may find that in nothing, you'll find the whole universe. So, just see what's there.